From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, we're in Paris, where a manhunt continues for a gunman terrorising media companies in the French capital. We examine Russia's grim aviation record after a passenger plane crashes, killing everyone on board.
Many smaller carriers are trying desperately to cut costs. Safety sometimes being neglected and they run for profit.
In the wake of the Philippines typhoon and the Midwest tornadoes, San Francisco offers an innovative approach to disaster management. We hear about the U.S. prison sentences shaming America.
Just the most heartbreaking stories of children who have had to live for 15, 20 years without a mother or father, parents who are elderly and sick and missing the child who used to care for them.
And we look back at the life and work of the uninhibited and outspoken author Doris Lessing. That's coming up on FSN Reports, after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Officials have confirmed that two people were killed in the U.S. state of Michigan this weekend after a series of storms and unusually powerful tornadoes struck the U.S. Midwest on Sunday. Those two bring the official toll to 8 people after 6 others were killed in Illinois, the worst affected state. Lorna Shattuck has more.
Weather officials issued tornado watches on Sunday morning for areas of Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Michigan, and Ohio, among others. But with winds of up to 190 miles an hour, the tornadoes were hard to escape quickly. By the time they'd passed on Sunday night, there was a trail of destruction across 12 states in the Midwest, with scores injured and thousands left homeless. More than 230 flights were cancelled at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport. Authorities are still clearing roads and re-establishing communications in many of the affected areas and fear the casualty list could climb.
The leader of one of Syria's key rebel groups has died after sustaining injuries from a strike by government forces last week. The death of Abdul Qadir Saleh is one of several battlefield setbacks for the rebels, raising a tension internationally over the changing strategic picture. Our Washington correspondent Daniel Wrenches reports.
The U.S. State Department, which backs the rebels, is continuing to encourage a Geneva-based peace effort, the most recent of which is the death of the founder of the 10,000-strong fighter group Tawhid Brigade, Abdul Qadir Saleh. President Bashar al-Assad's troops recently captured a group of opposition-held suburbs south of Damascus, and they've taken back 2 towns and a military base outside Aleppo, a city largely won by the Tawhid Brigade last year. Rebels are also on the defensive in the mountainous area of Kalamoun.
The trial of 2 Muslim converts accused of hacking to death a British soldier in broad daylight begins in London today. Drummer Lee Rigby was killed in London in May, close to his army barracks in Woolwich. Our UK correspondent Dan Whitehead has more.
The 25-year-old's murder provoked angry protests in London earlier this year. The Prime Minister David Cameron described the killing as an attack on the British way of life and a betrayal of Islam. 28-year-old Michael Adebolajo and 22-year-old Michael Adebowale will appear at the Old Bailey courtroom to deny murdering drummer Rigby, conspiracy to murder a police officer, and the attempted murder of a police officer. A 12-member jury will be selected on Monday, with the pair unlikely to be called until at least Tuesday. Mr Cameron and London Mayor Boris Johnson joined thousands of people, including veterans, for the soldier's funeral in the north of England back in July.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney has been forced to intervene in a private spat between his 2 daughters that has gone public. Liz Cheney wants to be the U.S. Senator from Wyoming, and her sister Mary is a lesbian, married with 2 children. Mr. Cheney is calling for compassion, and as Priscilla Huff reports, the dispute illustrates the broader conflict over same-sex marriage for the Republican Party.
Mary and Liz Cheney have not spoken for months. They were once the closest of sisters and highly involved in Republican politics with their father, Dick Cheney, the former vice president. Now, Liz Cheney is running for the U.S. Senate from Wyoming, and to appeal to that state's conservative values, she has flatly stated that she opposes same-sex marriage, describing it as just an area where she disagrees with her lesbian married sister. Mary Cheney and her wife Heather Poe are furious, publicly posting that Liz was the first to wish them happiness on their 2012 marriage. And to now have Liz Cheney say she does not support their right to marry is offensive. The dispute, which has made its way from the television to Facebook, is also highlighting Liz Cheney's lack of political authenticity, a political carpetbagger who moved from Virginia to Wyoming to run for the U.S. Senate, changing her positions to win votes.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average topped 16,000 for the first time in its history during Monday trading in New York, while the Standard & Poor's 500 topped 1,800. Stocks continue an extended rally as investors anticipate continued monetary stimulus from the U.S. Federal Reserve. And police in Paris are hunting a gunman who attacked the offices of French newspaper Libération, seriously injuring a photographer. He's thought to have also opened fire outside the bank Société Générale and forced a motorist to drive up the Champs-Élysées in the French capital. And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. A manhunt is underway in Paris after a gunman carried out a series of attacks on the offices of French media. The incidents have left one man in serious condition and seen police scramble to protect potential target sites across the capital. Earlier, I spoke to our Paris correspondent, Kate Moody, who began by telling me the latest.
This saga appears to have begun on Friday morning when a man, apparently fitting the same description as Monday's shooter, entered the headquarters of BFM TV, which is a 24-hour news channel here in Paris. He was brandishing a rifle and he threatened the director and journalists, but he escaped before actually injuring anyone. Now, fast forward to Monday morning, about 10 o'clock, a man also brandishing a rifle entered the headquarters of Libération, which is a left-leaning paper here in Paris. He did open fire, hitting a young photographer's assistant, about 27 years old, in the chest and stomach area. That young man has been taken to hospital, where doctors say he's fighting for his life. Now, this gunman fled before anyone was able to apprehend him. It's reported that he may have gotten on the metro then. About an hour and a half later, witnesses reported hearing gunfire outside a Société Générale bank in the La Défense business area, just on the outskirts of Paris. Shortly thereafter, a man, also with a gun, carjacked someone, forcing the driver to drive him about 6 kilometers inside of Paris towards the Champs-Élysées, which is, of course, the very busy tourist and shopping area. And that's the last known sighting of this man. Police have now said they do believe all these incidents were the same person. They're looking for one lone gunman here in Paris.
And in terms of the police investigation, authorities have now released an image of a suspect.
Police have issued a photograph of the man in question. They say he's about 35 to 45 years old, has graying hair, is currently wearing a sort of greenish or khaki-colored long jacket and carrying a bag. They don't know his identity. They've asked for anyone who might recognize him from the photo to get in touch with them. They also say they don't know of any motive behind these apparent shootings. They have raised security across the French capital, particularly in the Champs-Élysées area, which is where he was last confirmed to be seen. They've also raised security outside most media outlets in Paris in case he were to try and turn up and target another one of those. They've also increased their presence on the metro system because he does seem to have been using public transport to get around. So we're hearing that there's a very high presence of security personnel, police in the metro and other public transport hubs.
How are ordinary people in Paris reacting to the shootings and the increased police measures?
People have been really taken aback by this series of events. Gun violence or shootings like this are very rare in the French capital and across France in general, actually. So people have been taken aback, certainly surprised by the manhunt that seems to be going on throughout the streets of Paris at the moment. Now, people don't seem to be too nervous, actually, considering that there is a gunman at loose. He does seem to have been targeting media outlets for the moment, so there doesn't seem to be a sense of panic in the streets of Paris, but people certainly very anxious for the police to lock this guy down and for the manhunt to be over.
FSN's Kate Moody in Paris. Just a few blocks from the Capitol in Washington, a conservative civil liberties group petitioned a federal judge Monday to put a halt to the domestic spying activities of the US government, saying the suspicionless collection of phone and internet communications violates the Constitution. Justice Department lawyers present at the hearing said the High Court doesn't have the right to such matters of national security and surveillance, saying only the US Supreme Court could do so. That High Court announced today, without explanation, that it's rejecting a legal challenge to the NSA's programs. But judges and advocates alike say the issue will eventually reach its docket for a final ruling. FSN's Alice Olstein was at the court and brings us this report.
The U.S. Supreme Court refused this morning to take up a case filed by the Electronic Privacy Information Center, known as EPIC for short, that challenged the constitutionality of the government's program to collect the call records of millions of Verizon customers. Few were surprised at this decision, since the High Court rarely accepts direct petitions and prefers to hear cases that have worked their way up from lower courts. But Kalia Barnes, one of the lawyers working on the case for EPIC, said the Supreme Court is the only one with authority over the FISA court that authorized the broad surveillance.
This is the court that, this is the appropriate court to grant relief.
Federal District Court Judge Richard Leon expressed similar concerns at a hearing Monday, in which the libertarian-leaning civil liberties group Freedom Watch asked him to put an injunction on the NSA's phone data collection program. Judge Leon noted that Congress never explicitly said his court has the right to question the FISA court's judgment. But after the hearing, lead Freedom Watch attorney Larry Klayman told reporters that because the FISA court only hears from the government when making rulings, and those rulings often remain classified, he and other plaintiffs were forced to seek relief from the district court.
The American people, plaintiffs in this case, don't have the right to make any arguments in front of that court. That court is secret. We don't know what goes on. And under American law, we can go to a court that we're entitled to be in and make our arguments, and this judge can rule with regard to us.
Klayman, a former Justice Department prosecutor, alleged at Monday's hearing that he and his clients have been physically and electronically surveilled by the U.S. government, and warned another American revolution is likely if the NSA's data collection is allowed to continue. Multiple times he called the current U.S. government a police state and an Orwellian state, and he made several emotional appeals to Judge Leon to issue an injunction, calling him the last bastion of protection for the American people and the last century to protect us from tyranny.
And what we asked is he enter a preliminary injunction in order which simply requires the government to obey the law as it exists. Because the law as it exists says, unless there's some connection between an individual and terrorism, you can't get in to that person's record.
The Obama administration's lawyers responded Monday by saying the plaintiffs need to prove they were surveilled by the government and hurt in some way by that surveillance in order to have their day in court and question their ability to do so. They also held that the collection of domestic phone records does not violate citizens' reasonable expectation of privacy, citing the 1979 court ruling Smith v. Maryland to back up this point. Judge Leon retorted that an awful lot has changed since 1979, and the technology now available to the government is much more powerful and invasive. Klayman agreed, saying the current collection of so-called metadata is a privacy violation, one that has a chilling effect on free speech.
Anyone sitting there with the appropriate authority at the NSA can call up the records of your accountant, of your lawyer, even your urologist or gynecologist. It's unbelievable. And trace who you are in contact with. And the very fact that this is going on leads the American people and others not to want to talk on the phone, changes their daily way of life. They're in constant fear. And as a result, we ask this court to make a decision to do the courageous thing, to stand there for the American people. And that's what our founding fathers intended. They intended for judges to be a check to the tyranny of the other two branches of government.
Another major court challenge to the NSA's surveillance powers will come later this week. The American Civil Liberties Union will argue before a federal court in New York City this Friday that the government's collection of domestic call records violates the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Russian investigators have recovered the black box flight recorders from a Boeing 737 that crashed yesterday in the city of Kazan, killing all 50 people on board. The Tatarstan Airlines jet had been flying for nearly a quarter of a century, and some passengers aboard its previous flight to Moscow said they'd noticed strange vibrations during the landing. Investigators say they've ruled out a terrorist attack, but with Russia experiencing a growing number of fatal airline incidents, the government of President Vladimir Putin has set up a commission of inquiry to investigate the cause. FSN Simon Mark spoke to our Moscow bureau chief Anya Ardaeva.
The traffic controller who contacted the plane before the crash said that the crew told him that they were not ready for landing, did not specify the reason for that. So it still remains a mystery. And hopefully those two black boxes from that plane that were located on the scene would help to answer that question. And according to the Russian media reports, the son of the governor of Tatarstan is confirmed that he was on that flight, as well as the chief of the local branch of Russia's main security agency. And those two are among the victims, as well as two children and one British citizen. It was also reported that the plane was built 23 years ago and it has already had seven owners. The company insists that the aircraft was in good technical condition and that it last underwent a technical service in March. However, the media also reported that the Tatarstan Airlines, the carrier, reportedly experienced some financial problems recently.
Now, Russia's airline industry has been very substantially deregulated. You do have a large number of smaller airlines operating there, and in many cases operating with pretty ancient equipment.
That's correct. Yes, industry experts here have said in the past few months that most recent plane crashes could be blamed on the fact that many smaller carriers are trying desperately to cut costs as they're trying to beat the competition, and with safety sometimes being neglected in the run for profits. And also, they have complained that Russia is running very short on well-trained and professional pilots. There is a shortage of pilots here because pilots from other countries aren't really keen to come to Russia because the airlines here don't really offer competitive salaries. Also, they said that insufficient pilot training is another problem, as well as loose government controls over the industry. That's correct.
And so in an environment in which the world is preparing to come to Russia in 2014 for the Winter Olympics in the southern Russian city of Sochi, is there pressure now on the government to get this in hand and launch some sort of official series of inquiries or commission of investigation?
Certainly, there are calls to pay more attention to safety and to certainly for the government to impose some sort of control over the industry, which the government said it would do following that recent deadly incidents in Russia when in 2011 a crash in Yaroslavl killed 44 people on board that included a professional hockey team, and that was blamed on pilot error. And following that accident, many people here have complained and said that the government should really impose stricter controls on the industry, and the government has ordered the industry, the small carriers, to be checked and investigated by the government. But that, as we see, those measures did not bear any fruit.
Anya Ardaeva in Moscow. The vast support operation ongoing in the Philippines after Typhoon Haiyan and this weekend's tornado devastation here in the US place huge demands on the rescue services and affected communities. But in the San Francisco Bay Area, a new movement known as the sharing economy may present a solution. Using technology, startups in the field connect people with resources they aren't using to people who want to make use of them. Now city leaders want these small businesses to play a role in disaster planning. Rebecca Bowring has the story.
San Francisco, 600 kilometers of hills bordered by ocean, with some of the U.S.'s highest property prices. Residents aren't put off by the fact the city sits near the San Andreas Fault. In 1906, San Francisco was rocked by a powerful earthquake. Over 3,000 people died. And seismologists like Jack Boatwright from the U.S. Geological Survey predict there'll be another big one within 30 years.
The chances are rated about 2 out of 3 that will have a magnitude 6.7 or greater in the Bay Area.
City leaders have long advised San Francisco residents to have a disaster plan and emergency kits ready to go. Now they're turning to technology firms to help them prepare for the worst. The city government's planning team has struck a groundbreaking deal with a group called BayShare. All the tech startups within it are based on the concept of collaborative consumption. Websites offer products like cars, rooms, clothes and tools not to buy but to borrow for a short time. That means people can share resources that would otherwise be sitting around unused. Millicent Johnson is a co-founder of BayShare.
The sharing economy is really powered by citizens, and they are finding ways to share because there are unmet needs. It's the future of the way that we are going to live in cities, and I think our world is requiring that we share and collaborate more.
San Francisco is home to at least 20 sharing economy startups. Francisco Zamora from the city's Department of Emergency Management believes such fledgling businesses will play a key role if homes have to be evacuated or public transport fails.
They bring a unique skill set. We're emergency managers, we're not coders, so being able to tap into the skills and resources that companies like Airbnb, Lyft, TaskRabbit have, those BayShare companies, is really exciting for us.
The idea was born last year as Superstorm Sandy ravaged the U.S. East Coast. Airbnb and office space startup Liquid Space created alternative online systems to allow users to offer rooms free of charge to storm victims. They plan to roll out a similar service in the event of an emergency in the Bay Area. Doug Marinaro is president of Liquid Space.
We put out a plea on Twitter and on Facebook for people who had extra space to go click our Share Your Space button, upload their spaces, and make them available instantly to the community. And we don't charge anything for people to use Liquid Space.
This new disaster preparation partnership shows that local leaders see the potential in San Francisco's unique startup ecosystem. Both parties hope that in the future they'll be able to share their expertise with other cities across the U.S. and beyond. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
Here's a question for you. Imagine you're a judge. Before you is a man who's been caught trying to sell $10 of marijuana. What's an appropriate sentence? How about life without parole? Last year, there were more than 3,000 prisoners spending their lives behind bars for non-violent crimes. That's according to the American Civil Liberties Union. It's openly denounced by judges, but their hands are tied by mandatory sentencing laws. The report estimates the cost to keep these prisoners behind bars is nearly $2 billion. The report's author, Jennifer Turner, told FSN's Kate Fisher why this is an embarrassment for America.
The United States is one of only 20% of countries in the world that even have life without parole sentences. And most other countries reserve them only for people who've committed murder or multiple murders and provide for review of those sentences. So we're virtually alone in our willingness to sentence people to die in prison for nonviolent crimes.
And why do we have it here in America?
Well, frankly, the prevalence of these sentences, of life without parole sentences for nonviolent crimes, is a symptom of the more than four decades of the war on drugs and tough on crime policies that led to the passage of laws like mandatory minimum sentences and three strikes laws, many of which mandate a life without parole sentence, regardless of the severity of the offense, regardless of the person who's being sentenced. And the result of that is that people are being sentenced to life without parole for siphoning gasoline from a truck or for having a bottle cap smeared with an unweighable amount of heroin residue.
It all seems just so irrational, doesn't it? Why can't it be changed, and why can't judges have a say when so many of them denounce it? Why isn't it changing?
Well, it is irrational. It defies common sense that we would sentence people to life in prison for minor and low-level crimes and nonviolent crimes. These sentences are grotesquely out of proportion to the crimes that are committed. And in fact, at this moment, I think it's a historic moment for potential reform in the United States. Federal judges for years have been objecting to these sentences. And case after case after case I was reviewing, the sentence, the judge outraged on the bench would say, I oppose the sentence. It's a travesty. I want to be on the record as both a judge, a citizen, and a taxpayer that these policies don't make sense and they're counterproductive and they're wasting taxpayer dollars. But more recently, because of depleted state coffers, state governors and politicians across both sides of the political aisle are starting to acknowledge that this experiment, these 40 years of policies have been a failure and that it's time to make reforms.
And are you hopeful that that can happen?
I am hopeful. I mean, One difficulty is that President Obama has had a terrible clemency record. He has the worst record of any modern president. He's pardoned 5 turkeys while in office, but commuted the sentence of only 1 prisoner. President Obama is about to pardon another turkey on Thanksgiving, and he could commute the sentence of some of the federal prisoners. And Congress has 2 bills currently pending, 2 bipartisan bills that they could be supporting and could potentially pass. So reform could be imminent, but it will require the support of the public. But beyond that, I do feel positive about the possibilities for sentencing reform, and it's partly because of the tremendous expense of these policies. We found that the cost of imprisoning just the 3,278 people who are currently serving life without parole for nonviolent crimes, that the cost of imprisoning them for the rest of their lives instead of a more proportionate sentence is nearly $1.8 billion.
I mean, that is astounding, isn't it? And it's not, though. It's not just the cost to the state. It's also a huge cost to society, and it takes its toll on families who lose a family member, effectively.
Absolutely. I've spoken with many, many, many family members of the prisoners whose stories I profiled in this report, and just the most heartbreaking stories of children who have had to live for 15, 20 years without a mother or father, parents who are elderly and sick and missing the child who used to care for them. And it's really, these policies are affecting many, many more than the thousands who are incarcerated.
Jennifer Turner talking to our correspondent, Kate Fisher. And finally, she was the famously outspoken novelist who spent her writing career breaking the mold. Doris Lessing died this weekend at her home in London at the age of 94. She produced dozens of novels, short stories, essays and poems, but it was the complex relationship between men and women, as well as social and racial inequality, that shone out from her works. Miss Lessing was famously unseduced by the trappings of fame, greeting the news that she'd won the Nobel Prize for Literature with the words, "I couldn't care less." For more on Doris Lessing's remarkable career, we spoke to Ben McNally, owner of Toronto's leading independent bookshop.
I think mostly it's because she was so frank in her writing and in her life. You know, she held nothing back in terms of what she felt and basically, you know, what it was like for a woman to live during the period in which she lived. As far as I'm concerned, it's individualism and a willingness to stick by one's principles through thick and thin. I mean, you know, she was always willing to take on unpopular themes and you know, come at things from a different angle and to be straight up about how she felt, right?
Describe her literary style a little bit, because it was quite complex, wasn't it?
Well, and quite varied, as a matter of fact. I mean, you know, here's a woman who certainly deserved the Nobel Prize on the basis of her flexibility and her willingness to take on new things. You know, she's probably best known for The Golden Notebook, which is, you know, a great novel. But, you know, as far as we're concerned, you know, her autobiography is a absolutely stunning book, and she's big in Canada because in I think late 80s she delivered the Massey lecture, and that was a particularly interesting book. It was called The Prisons We Choose to Live Inside. She talked in 6 parts about individual freedoms and cultural restrictions.
And you mentioned her autobiography there. She did have quite an interesting personal life, didn't she?
Yes, absolutely. She sure did. You know, she wrote about going back to Zimbabwe, which was very interesting. And, of course, she was a bit of a Sufi, I think, and a standard bearer for outside-the-box thinking.
And her personality was famously curmudgeonly. She didn't always get good headlines for that, did she?
Well, but too bad, don't you think? I mean, I think that she has every right to be a little bit grouchy because, you know, people always sort of took her to task for being candid and for being what she stood for.
Ben McNally speaking to FSN's Lorna Shaddick. And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there, @featurestory. Coming up on Tuesday, the Senate tackles virtual currency. That's Tuesday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.